Welcome to Eco Living in Action, a half-hour sustainable living show with Maureen Howard. Maureen chats with a different guest each week about their sustainability activities and initiatives, from advice on tiny houses to rooftop gardens to wildlife-friendly farming practices. Maureen's guests are passionate individuals who are making a difference. Eco Living in Action, proudly supported by Sustainable Dunedin City.
Kia ora, welcome to Eco Living in Action. I'm Maureen Howard, host of this show. Now, this week our topic is dairy farming and one farmer's response to the many urgent environmental challenges that are facing this industry. David DeProse is farming a large dairy herd in Purukinu in Southland. David is a dairy farmer with a difference. He is chair of the Purukinu Catchment Group. He is a committee member of the Three Rivers Catchment Group. And he's recently joined Te Ao Marama, a Runanga-created entity that looks at the water and land and feeds advice on policy, procedures and perspectives to assist with legislation. I caught up with David at the Permaculture Hui, at which he was one of the guest speakers. This interview with David was recorded on the 6th of April 2019.
Yeah, I didn't set out to be a dairy farmer with a difference, but I find that I've ended up being the dairy farmer with a bit of a difference. And some of the things that I've been thinking about have led me down a path that's created that difference.
Right, and you're based at Purukinu?
That's correct.
And whereabouts is that exactly?
So it's in Western Southland, and it's just north of Riverton, and right. It feeds into the Riverton estuary.
Right, right. And it's a community still of primarily family-led dairy farmers, isn't that right?
That's correct, yeah. There's 60 farmers in the catchment, and prominently farmers that have moved there, but also farmers that have been living here for five or six generations.
And you yourself, have you come from farming family?
Yeah, I've come from five generations of farming, but originally started up in the Waikato, so didn't come from these places.
Right, so you brought that knowledge down.
Yeah.
So there's been a bit of a turning point for you in terms of how you've done the dairying, because now you're starting to do things differently, aren't you?
Yeah, I guess the dream was always to own land, and when you get the privilege of owning land, you then can start to put your finger mark on it or what your ideals onto it. So often a farmer will reflect or is very proud of his farm because of it shows who he is, and so when I bought my farm, it enabled me to be able to show who I am as a farmer. Mm. And that was quite different and being in the 50-50 share milking system, where you were basically doing what that farmer wanted with your cows. So you had to put up or make do with what was there. So I did five or six share milking jobs of 3 years primarily. And so I got to understand different farming systems apart from what I'd learnt as a child growing up. And from my grandparents and great-grandparents.
And because of, you know, your background and your family history, you come with that farming hat on and being a changed person who cares, well, you care deeply about, you know, nature and the environment too. You find yourself a bit on the edge of things, would you say? You know, like in terms of being a change maker, you know, and a gumboot in each camp, I might say.
Yeah, like I say, I didn't purposely start off farming to be different from the rest, but I always had a love for the nature and I always had a love for the animals. And I guess as farming's changed or has been changing over the last few years, I found that I've actually got myself out onto the edge, not because I wanted to be, but because that's where the edge started to show. And so I found that I was in a space which I didn't expect to be, but I'm happily in that space because it's very much my passion and what I love doing. And love being in the environment. That's why I don't like an office job. I've always liked the outdoors and being with nature and understanding nature and looking at the signs.
Right. Yeah. And you've got quite a big farm, isn't that right?
Yeah, I've actually got two farms. I've got an 800 cow farm, and I've also got a 250 cow farm in another catchment over at Wyndham. So it's quite good because they're quite diversely different.
Right. Right.
And that means that you've got to think differently for both farms, even though you're producing milk. It's all different. So and it's good to be able to work in two different catchments and two different farms.
And gives you insight in how to, the kind of solutions that you, that are, would be different for each of those places, I guess.
Well, it just sort of shows that the, you know, we talk often about the same things, but the way that we go about doing them can be quite different. And it also enables us to sort of, it enables me to sort of get experiences of, you know, not just one farm and not just one area. So I'm actually in two distinctively different areas, and so I have two lots of different conversations. Mm. So it enables me to sort of hear different voices and to appreciate those different voices. And then also when it comes to solution, so I can take parts of it, but then I'm also adapting it to what the local environment's requiring.
So stepping back a little bit, so you came down, you've come down here to do your farming, and I guess it's you know, you bought the land, and so it, as you said, it's something that reflects who you are. And so what were some of the things that you first noticed that you thought, this doesn't reflect who I am?
I've always seen a strong connection between the land and the water, and so one of the first things that I started was fencing off the waterways. And when I looked at the waterways, I didn't look at a 3 metre buffer zone like the, you know, what would be considered good practice. I looked at what that part of the land needed in landscaping that, and sort of allowing for bigger buffers if we needed to. I wasn't so much worried about converting all the land into grass. I wanted to sort of have a balanced, and biosecurity was one of the values.
So is this like putting a planted riparian margin along the waterways? Is that what you did, or?
I was very fortunate because it was in the Porokino, and it was only first logged over, so it was only a first cutting. So what they often did when they developed land is they would go through and cut out the big trees, and then they would push all the other trees over, and then they would windrow that, and then they would burn that out. So what my farm was is they'd gone through and cut the big trees out, the big kaikatea, and then they had windrowed it up into windrows, but they hadn't gone back through and reburnt those. So, and that had been left for about 20 years. So there'd been regeneration in some of those windrows. So what I did is I went back through those windrows, sorted out the good areas, the ones that had regenerated really well, and I fenced those out. And then I also fenced off the margins. It was very hard to get trees away from the rivers. So quite often they were the areas that were left when they went through and cut the trees out. And so it was very easy for us to...
So there was a natural margin?
There was a natural margin, just because it was too hard to take them out with the logging. So we could just reinstate that. So we've got some beautiful kaikateas, which are the queens of the forest, on our property. And we've got some totara and other plants growing now that'll be 20 years old. And enabling... Mother Nature has a beautiful way of healing itself.
Yes.
If you allow it to rejuvenate, and, you know, we've got all this native regenerating because we hadn't taken it right back to a fully nullified system.
Mm, so. But it does need that little bit of care, the fencing. And do you do a bit of predator control as well?
Yeah, predator control, fencing. We've got quite a few other species coming in that, like the Chilean flamethrower, and... you know, we have a bit of trouble with elderberry, which even though it makes a lovely drink, it's not ideal in the understory of a native forest. So there's quite a bit of work in looking after or enabling the right plants to flourish, and that takes a bit of time. We've also re-established wetlands and some sediment traps, and so we're sort of experimenting without just blanket planting with natives or a species of, we're sort of looking at using the gorse as a so it's not super expensive, but we're not just trying to fix it up straight away. I don't actually like seeing these monocultural corridors of natives which are out of place, eco-sourcing and plants being in the right place from the right area is really critical for me even planting. So
yeah.
So I've seen a lot of plantings where they've come in from, you know, I'm originally from the North Island, but, you know, you see North Island plants standing up in South Island ecosystems, and it's destroying even that side of it. You know, we don't even destroy, you know, we think we're doing the right thing, but we're creating another problem.
Mm. And it's kind of in the rush, you know, the rush to kind of, you know, make things better again. But really, we need to just sit back and really think about, and as you say, let nature do the regeneration, perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's probably some of the faults of the industry is we've tried to, you know, put the Band-Aid over really quickly. And then, you know, what we've actually by putting the Band-Aid over, we've taken out the air from the infection, but that's actually created another problem. And so I think it's, we need time to think through these things, but we need to, we also need to get on with it, because we just can't keep going, oh, we need time. We actually need to start doing stuff. And if we do something wrong, we've got to say, you know, we've got to be brave enough to say, hey, we've actually got that wrong, and we need to reassess this and look at what we need to do to remediate it or not to do it again.
So another of the issues that I wanted to talk about is what we're feeding our dairy cattle, because that is a big part of the problem. And I guess I'm thinking primarily of the palm kernel meal. Is it the palm kernel meal that we tend to feed the cattle? And so what do you see being the directions that we need to be taking with the dairy in terms of feed?
So cows naturally cope very well with grass. It's a natural feed for them. Originally cows used to eat the prairie grasses, and that's how they used to travel around. With us introducing other feeds like palm kernel and grain feeding, we're getting more production out of our cows. It's become more European in the way that we do things, so we're getting higher production out of our cows, but it's actually changing the way that the milk tastes and looks. And with that, with that happening, it's giving us more milk, but it's also creating more nutrient loss, and then that's loading the soil up harder or heavier, and so we're getting more nutrient runoffs, and we're having to modify the system even more than what the grass is growing on the farm.
Right. So you're meaning that, well, we have to then add stuff to get the grass to grow to the same degree, is that right?
Yeah, that's another way that we can do it, is we can add something to the grass to grow, make it grow more. So, you know, some of that's been the innovation of New Zealand dairy, you know, some would say to the contrary, but, you know, adding artificial fertiliser, that's enabled us to grow more grass. Super was a big breakthrough. At one stage,
there were
superphosphate.
Yeah,
that was a big breakthrough, but we had a very shotgun approach. We overused it. You know, we've cut back on a lot of that stuff. Now we've got a lot more fertilizers, different sort of fertilizers. We soil test every year so that we put on exactly what we need. But now we're going past that, and we're saying we're actually introducing feeds. So some of these farmers now are introducing, you know, up to, you know, half their food is in imported feed, which is not even growing on the farm, and they're sustaining high stocking rates, which is not necessarily, you know, the soil can't even cope with that. And so then you're getting these breakdowns of farming systems, and people then say, oh, that's a dairy cows, but there's differences even within systems and even within dairy farming. So, you know, we'd like to think that organic's one thing, but there's actually differences even within conventional farming.
Yeah. So do you think that, you know, obviously all of this feed costs money. Can you get back to a balance that's still economical for the farmers, you know, cut back on some of these feeds, perhaps have to reduce the numbers of animals on per hectare? Is that possible to do that in a cost-effective way, you know, just by reducing your overheads?
Yeah, so we got caught up in the 2009 bubble, I'll call it, where prior to that, 2008, we were lent a lot of money to be able to grow our businesses. So in 2009, the banks started recalling some of that money. Our debt ratios were higher than what we actually owned. And so the banks were getting very anxious about farmers having that ability to pay back. So that sort of led or enabled us, or as farmers we wanted to drive more production. So that led some farmers going down the grain track. And then others, like myself, we went down the, okay, we've got to grow the feed on farm, it's got to be grass, and we've got to do it very cost effectively. And so I could cut my cost down per kilo of milk solids or per litre of milk, because I was looking at the inputs I was putting in. I knew exactly where my costs were coming in. And so one of my boasts was that I could actually carry on farming when people were demanding more. I could actually do it for less because I was utilising my grass better. So utilisation of grass is, we might grow, say, 10 tonne a year, but it can be up to 20 tonne in some of the irrigated areas.
So in what ways are you getting that improvement in terms of your grass?
So we don't utilise 100% when we grow the grass, so not every blade of grass that we grow we harvest. The cows will tramp on some. There's a utilisation of the grass when we in farming circles. So some farmers will get 60%, and the better farmers are getting up to 85%. You actually don't ever get 100%, but you can get up to 85% utilisation of high-quality feed into your cows, which then drives your production.
So is this just how you move the cattle on, that you feed them in one place and then move them to let the grass recover? Is that how you're getting it?
That's part of it, but it's also the right time that you come back to that grass. It's also the stage of growth of the grass. It's also the species of grass. Mm-hmm. They all factor the palatability of the grass and for the cow to utilise that feed.
Right.
And some people say, you know, it's the fertiliser and the density of the food too that enables that animal to utilise that feed.
Now, some farmers are going back to a more mixed species thing, you know, because obviously different animals crop the ground in different ways. Is that something that you've looked into?
Yeah, it's there's a bit of a challenge because grass only grows at a grass photosynthesizes. That's how it creates its energy. And to add another species in, like they were doing in the 1950s, was actually affecting the ability for that grass to grow. Mm. So dairy farming has become very good at growing the maximum amount of grass. We know what to graze the grass down to, what height. It's 1,500 kilos of dry matter is ideal, and then that enables the maximum growth for the next period of time. So, and it's usually about 21 days.
Is what you have to leave it.
Yeah. But it varies at different times of year because grass grows at different times of year. So people know that by how many times they've got to mow their lawns. As a dairy farmer, you know, part of the challenge of management is knowing when to speed up and when to slow down.
Right. So obviously a slow down in the winter time.
Yeah. So this time of year we're slowing down. Yeah. We talk about the three tiller stage, which is the maximum stage for, you know, the plant, once it gets past the third tiller, the fourth tiller will die. Mm. And so we know that once that third tiller gets there, that the cow's got to be on that paddock at that time grazing that grass.
Right, so or else the leaf dies down.
The leaf dies and doesn't add any more value to the plant.
Now, if because you're not adding a whole lot of additives then to the soil, are you?
No, we soil test now, so we are very specific in what we put on.
Right.
So we are still using artificial fertilisers. We still use nitrogen, but we are being very specific in when we put it in and why we put it in.
Right. And one of the advantages, this is slightly on a different topic, but, you know, you mentioned earlier about you know, the water use, but, you know, you've come down here. You don't need to irrigate down here, isn't that right?
So when I came down from Matamata, because originally I was in Matamata, I came down through the South Island, and what I wanted to do was look for areas that could grow the grass naturally and could do it with natural inputs. So I was looking at the sun, the air, the soil, and I ended up in Southland bypassing Canterbury because I didn't personally like the irrigation. Even though I could grow more feed, I didn't like the way that they produce that feed. Now, there's some areas in Canterbury which are good, but there's definitely some areas that are, you know, they're growing it on stones and that's not good. So I ended up in Southland, and I was also looking for when the grass grew. It was very important for me to be, the grass had to grow at the right time of year. We do have trouble with winter down here, and that's going to be a challenge going forward, is the way that we winter cows. But it's a small problem compared to that we actually grow grass all year round.
Right, yeah. And I guess the other big challenge that you talked about in your talk is kind of where the political power lies in the dairy industry. And not everybody might know this, that, you know, your power is the amount of voting rights that you have with Dairy NZ depends on the amount of milk that you're actually producing. Isn't that right? Now, imagine if this is the old way that democracy used to work, didn't it?
Yeah. You know,
the more land you owned, the more votes you had or something. Is there a solution to that, and how can it come about?
Well, it would be ideal if we got one vote, one person, but It's going to really shake it at the top level. We've also got the same challenges within Fonterra, and so we're getting big players calling the shots and hiding in behind the little dairy farmer. Yeah, I'm noticing a lot more in the farming circles is that I used to be an AB technician, so I went on to a lot of farms, and it wasn't a specific area of farms. It was a you know, in an area. And what I started to notice was there's less farmer owners and there's a lot more corporate farmers with, you know, people from other countries, which, you know, that's what we needed because Kiwis weren't coming on to the farms. And the problem with that was they didn't seem to show the same sort of care for their place and their environment and their animals.
I'm just wondering is that something that listeners and consumers can help with, you know, in terms of it's a difficult kind of issue to fix from the inside, isn't it? Because you've got this power imbalance, you know, of you know, the votes are given to the people with the most, and obviously nobody wants to give up power.
Yeah.
Where do you see change happening?
I think we've got to really define what farming is. We can't just assume that it's this dairy farming. I'll use dairy farming because that's what I'm most used to, but I also know in sheep farming the same issues are going on. That we can't just assume that dairy farming is a family, mum and dad and the kids, milking 60 cows or 150 cows or 200 cows or 400 cows. It's actually something quite different to that. And I think the problem with the rural urban divide is not so much that we're rural, and is that when the people went to the town, they took that with them. They took we were brought up on a small farm, 160 cows. Mum and dad used to go out and milk the cows. What's changed from that is the people that bought those farms have become bigger farm owners. I'm personally a farmer of 800 cows. It's a combination of three farms. You know, one of my operations, the other little farm, it was a combination of three farms. So what we've actually got now is something quite different. And I'm speaking as somebody that's already amalgamated a lot of farms. We have to know what we want as New Zealand agriculture. If we want the family farm owning the land and running the land, now we can't do that in its entirety, but there is a value in mum and dad and the kids being on the family farm. And you see that portrayed a little bit through the media, but the reality is it's something quite different once you get out away from there. And you know, and it's unfortunately we're getting spotlights in certain parts of the industry, and then we don't like the bits that we can't actually see. And then we get a glimpse of the bits that we don't like to see, and then we actually, you know, we think the whole spotlight, the whole shows that, but the reality is there's parts of it that you can't actually understand at the moment.
Well, David, what makes you hopeful for the future? What are the kind of conversations you're having that are making you think, oh, okay, there is a way forward for and to improve the dairy industry?
I think for me the advantage is that what we've always had is starting to show signs of stress and fracture. And I think the hope is that we actually have to start talking about the shared resources. It's no longer you own the land, you know, it's your right to do that. We are talking about the air, we're talking about the water. And because we're talking about that, it's actually everybody's challenge. And it's very easy to point the finger and blame the farmer, you know, because they happen to be the one on the land. The reality is it's a shared thing, and we need to show shared responsibility towards how we manage and how we, you know, move forward from here.
Yeah.
And the answer's not going to be just with the landowner. It's not going to be with the people that are on it. It's going to be with the conversations of the consumer, understanding what they're buying. The answer's not necessarily just disappearing and going to buy vegetables, because you don't know necessarily how your vegetables are growing either. And, you know, it's not veganism, it's not a way of farming or a way of living. It is understanding why you're doing it. And I don't condone any of those things. As a dairy farmer, you'd think I'd say, you know, I'd condone veganism. I don't. I endorse it, because we can't actually supply everybody with meat and milk around the world. So,
yeah.
And as the world population changes, we're going to have to change the way that we do things anyway. So.
And thank you for listening. I'm Maureen Howard, and this is Eco Living in Action. And on today's show, I was chatting with David DeProus from Perukinu, who is a dairy farmer in the Southland area. If you'd like to listen to the show again, you can download it as a podcast from the Otago Access Radio website at oar.org.nz. Eco Living in Action is supported by Sustainable Dunedin City. So thanks for listening and hope to catch you next week.
Sustainable Dunedin City aims to facilitate a positive, secure and sustainable future for Dunedin. We're local people interested in issues of climate change, declining energy security and sustainability. Is there effect our city? Sustainable Dunedin City produces a regular online newsletter of sustainability related events, hosts regular green drink sessions and organises the Big Green Challenge. For more information or to join, go to sustainabledunedincity.org.nz.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October skies. You know the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. You know I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. You know the night's magic seem to whisper and hush. You know the soft moonlight seems to shine in your blush. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love? Make love to you tonight. I can't wait till the morning has come. Yet I know now the time is just right, and straight into my arms you will run. And when you come, my heart will be waiting to make sure that you're never alone. There and then all my dreams will come true, dear. There and then I will make you my own. And every time you just tremble inside. Then I know how much you want me that you can't hide. Can I just have one more moon dance with you, my love? Or can I just make some more romance with you, my love? La la la. magic name. Can't